Hello, and welcome to Line One, Your Health Connection. I'm your host, Dr. Jillian Woodruff. The skin is our body's largest organ, making up about 15% of our body weight. It's our first line of defense, shielding us from environmental toxins, regulating our body temperature, and helping to get rid of waste through sweat. It's also a mirror of our overall health. Changes in the skin's appearance can often signal underlying health issues. Joining us today is Dr. Courtney Bagayoko, a board-certified dermatologist and fellow of the American Academy of Dermatology. She earned her medical degree from the University of Virginia School of Medicine and completed her dermatology training at Wake Forest Baptist Medical Center. She is the owner of Anchorage Dermatology and Cosmetics and has expertise in complex medical dermatology conditions, hair loss, the treatment of skin of color, and the management of vulvar skin conditions. Dr. Bagayoko, welcome to Line One.
Thank you for having me, Jillian.
I'm so happy that you're here. And you can also join our conversation. Do you experience dry and itchy skin? Have you struggled with a chronic skin condition? Call us toll-free statewide at 1-888-353-5752. 1-888-353-5752. In Anchorage at 907-550-8433. Or email us at line1@alaskapublic.org. So, Dr. Bagayoko, I have eagerly been awaiting this conversation, particularly due to my own vested interest in the skin conditions, mine particularly with the skin of the vulva and the vagina, but there is so much interrelation. So I'm excited to really talk about that connection and our skin's health and our overall well-being. But let's get to know you a little bit better. And I want to know what inspired you to pursue a career in dermatology.
Okay, that's a great question. I went to medical school at the University of Virginia. I finished in 2013, but I was one of those medical students that didn't like much of anything. I went to medical school bright-eyed and bushy-tailed, thinking I'm going to save the world. I'm going to treat all these patients and save the world. And then in medical school, as I went through my rotations, I realized I didn't like many of the specialties. There were a lot of sick people. Some of our patients died. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it was emotionally very taxing. And I felt like I had made one of the biggest mistakes of my life going to medical school. And then one of my dearest friends, Dr. Ron Bosley, who was a friend from prior to medical school, he matched in dermatology. And he said, you know, this is something you should look into. And I was like, huh, are those even doctors? Because I had never heard of a dermatologist, going to medical school. And the thought of doing all this and then becoming a dermatologist, I was unsure about it. So at that time, I emailed the chair of the dermatology program at University of Virginia, and I asked if I can come shadow him during Thanksgiving break of 2011. And I spent 5 days in the clinic at University of Virginia. And it was lovely. It was a lovely experience. We treated so many different types of patients. I saw so many different skin conditions. And the thing I loved most about it is the days were really exciting. So in one clinic day, you can see an acne, then do a skin check, then do a filler patient, then see a melanoma patient, then do a lupus patient, then do a surgery, and then do a laser procedure, and then do a Botox. And that could be one day. And so I was always on my toes. I was challenged. The patients weren't very sick. We did have sick patients, but most patients were healthier. So just on an emotional level, it was, you know, easier for me. And I decided to go into dermatology. I think the other thing that really helped is that chairman encouraged me to look into skin of color dermatology, something I had never heard of. And I reached out to a famous dermatologist, Dr. Amy McMichael. She was the chair at Wake Forest, and she became my mentor and taught me everything I know about hair loss and skin of color. And that really helped really connect me to dermatology, because now there was an area that I could specialize in in which there was a huge need. And so I think it just fit my personality. You know, I'm with suffering of people or patients, I'm not good at compartmentalizing that. Like, I really get emotionally invested in the patients. And so with derm, I think just because it's a little bit lighter and there isn't as much suffering in sickness, I've just been, you know, I was able to delve into that field a little better.
What an interesting story. I don't know that I've heard that before. And I don't think you're alone with how you're feeling. You know, I think many of us go into medical school with a save the world, you know, mentality, and that's what we want to do. And there's not a lot of thought given to the emotional toll that it takes. And especially, yeah, there's certain fields that is quite high. And a lot of people, I think, you know, may have a problem separating that and not taking that emotional burden home with them. So I don't think you're alone. I think we have very similar specialties in that sense, where majority of my patients are extremely healthy too. And, you know, they need care too, because now we're talking much more about prevention. And I think in your field, you have a lot of talk about, you know, prevention of skin diseases and also prevention of, you know, medical diseases that manifest with skin issues. So you mentioned hair loss, and like you said, hair loss, especially in skin of color, and hair loss in all people, men and women, is such an emotionally charged situation. So you had some special training in this aspect. Do all dermatologists deal with skin of color, or do you sort of kind of specialize in different areas?
I think all dermatologists can treat skin of color. You know, we're trained in residency, especially depending on where you go to residency, you are going to meet people of different shades. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I think most of all dermatologists can address skin of color. But I think that there is, you know, the understanding some of the cultural aspects and trying to really understand, you know, how a patient lives their lives and what is important to them in taking care of that patient. You know, but I think overall, from what I've seen, especially in our community, most dermatologists do a great job at treating skin of color.
Are there specific subspecialties or fellowship training for dermatologists?
There are. So I didn't do any post-residency training, but there are different fellowships people can go into, dermatologists can go into, to get specialized training. So dermatopathology is reading this tissue slides under the microscope. That's an extra year of residency, extra year of fellowship after residency.
So they're looking at skin biopsies and determining if they're cancerous or non-cancerous.
Exactly. And that takes an additional year. And there, you know, so you could either go you could be a dermatologist who does that an extra year, or you could be a pathologist, a general pathologist who does an extra year of dermatopathology. There's also surgical dermatology, which is usually Mohs surgery. So that's
Mohs surgery.
Mm-hmm, so Mohs surgery is a type of skin cancer removal surgery where it's done in office, it's done under local anesthesia. We remove a skin cancer, we take that tissue and section it and look at it in office live under the microscope to make sure all the margins are negative. And once all of the margins are negative, we could then close the tissue. And so these patients aren't put under general anesthesia, and we know we cleared the margin in the office. And so that's a special type of surgery called Mohs surgery, and that's an extra year of fellowship. Wow. And we have two Mohs surgeons in this state.
Oh, wow. Mm-hmm. And by margins, you mean you're looking at the lesion or the abnormality, and you want to make sure that you get the border that doesn't have any abnormality on it.
Exactly. You want to make sure there are no cancer cells at the edge, because then there could still be cancer left in the patient. There's complex medical dermatology, which is treating patients with like lupus and dermatomyositis and much more serious dermatologic conditions. There's not that many of those fellowships, but those fellowships do exist. And then there's pediatric dermatology. Mm-hmm. We have one pediatric derm in this state, Dr. Gina Brown, and that's another year. I believe that's another year of fellowship. And then there's aesthetics resident fellowships, where people learn more advanced, cutting edge aesthetic procedures, including, you know, more advanced lasers, obviously all the injectables, some, you know, surgical procedures as well. So, yeah, those are the more specialized dermatologists.
Interesting. Well, what are the most common skin conditions that you see in your office?
Yeah, so, you know, I would say the most common condition I see is acne. That's definitely the most common. Many kids, young adults, adults have acne. I think the statistic is something between 85% of people between 12 and 30 experience acne at some point. So it's very, very common. And it's on your face. It's not like it's mm-hmm. on your calf or the back of your hand. It's on your face. It's like your main moneymaker. It's a thing everybody sees when they meet you. So, you know, a lot of people are really bothered by their acne, which brings them into the dermatologist. Some people go to their primary care doctors, and some primary care doctors do a very good job treating acne. Actually, some of the things I learned treating acne came out of primary care. But acne is definitely the most common. In Alaska, we see a lot of eczema or atopic dermatitis. You know, this is a very harsh climate we live. The air is very, very dry at least half the year. And so we get tons of eczema. And actually, some of the worst cases of eczema I've ever seen are here in Alaska. A lot of psoriasis. I want to say a lot of skin cancer, but that probably wouldn't be totally true, seeing that saying that I trained in North Carolina where I feel like everybody had skin cancer.
There's a lot of sun there.
We don't have nearly as much sun here, but we do have a lot of people that snowbird or travel to Arizona and Nevada and Hawaii, and so they get bursts of
Very
sun.
True.
Or they grew up in Texas or Colorado, or they hike and ski, so they're just exposed to the elements, so we do get skin cancer. And then we see, you know, psoriasis. We see tons of hidradenitis suppurativa, which is, you know, the
they
only
call
way
those boils.
Yeah, the
sometimes.
Boils in the skin folds, which is
yes.
a really awful mm-hmm. condition to have. Mm-hmm. So those are some of the more common ones we see.
I think that we should probably get into them one by one then and see how much we can cover. But first, we do have our first caller. So let's welcome Amelia from Eagle River to line one. Hi, Amelia.
Hey, thank you, doctors. Thanks for taking my call.
Yes.
I have kind of, I don't know if it's rare or not, but I have pleodermitis. And I've had it since I was a kid.
Did you say plea? Dermatitis? Pleodermitis?
Yeah, well, it's a buildup of the skin around the hair follicles. So
oh.
I shed my skin too fast, and it builds up around the hair follicles, and it makes these little bumps.
So maybe it's like a hyperkeratinization
thing? It's not.
Something like that.
Okay.
I don't know. And nobody's ever been able to really pinpoint it. It's never been treated. I've just lived with it. I'm 43 now. And
what are the symptoms besides
painful,
the bumps?
Nothing horrible, but it's just something I notice. You know, it's little bumps on the back of my arms and my legs, and it's not acne, not at all.
Are you saying,
the hair follicles? I shed my
yes.
skin very fast, and it doesn't seem to shed around the hair follicle.
Do you mean actually keratosis pilaris? Is that the condition you're...
I think that's what you mean. Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay.
Okay.
Yep. So that's actually a very common skin condition. I tell patients, I see this every single day. I'm not sure if you're...
I wonder if they know that it's an issue always.
Yeah. Well, you know, I tell patients that it's more of a variation of normal than a true skin condition. I mean, in some people it can be inflamed or irritated. But it's one of those conditions that it's really hard to make it go away because it's almost, I mean, I feel like the skin is almost supposed to be like that on these exterior aspects of the arms and legs. But I could understand that it bothers you. And there are definitely things that we give patients to help minimize it. Have you been prescribed any creams or emollients for it?
But I just, you know, I moisturize and scrub and try my best, but I still have the bumps sometimes.
Yeah.
You know?
Have you tried like CeraVe SA or ammonium lactate cream?
Yeah.
No.
Why don't you try that? I mean, CeraVe SA is CeraVe with salicylic acid. Amlactin is like over-the-counter ammonium lactate, and that can help soften the skin and try to decrease some of the shedding. And then there's other prescription medications we can prescribe. I even had a woman who was getting married and wanted to minimize hers, and we tried laser on hers. So there's things you can do, but I tell people some of it is you just can't make go away, but the goal is to try to make it a little better for patients. But it's very
That's
common.
What I figured.
Yeah, I'm sorry you're struggling with that.
Nah, it's first world problems.
Well, that's really good advice, Dr. Bagayoko. And really, you're using some ingredients and things that you can get at any local store. And it sounds like they're things that do exfoliation of your skin. So it's good to not have to do very expensive treatments, but to know that these things are out here in different levels. So I think moving on to other things that require some exfoliation is talking about acne, which you said is one of the more common things that you see in your office. So can you just tell us briefly about what acne is and the different types of acne that we could experience?
Sure. So, you know, in general, acne is an inflammatory skin condition that usually involves the face. It could also involve the chest, shoulders, and back. It's very, very common. It really is annoying, although it's, you know, presents no real threat to anyone's life, but it could affect, you know, just how they live their day-to-day life.
Self-esteem. And
absolutely. Mm-hmm. And so usually when I see an acne patient, whether it be a child, a young teen, an older teen, or an adult, the first thing, you know, I do is determine the type of acne they have. So then there's different types of acne. So there's inflammatory acne, which are kind of deeper cystic or red inflamed papules or pustules involving most of the face. There's comedonal acne, which I think is more mild, kind of really high up acne that is, or people think of as whiteheads or blackheads, are not necessarily inflamed, but they do.
Pimples?
Yeah. I think people mostly call them whiteheads or blackheads, you know, because pimples, when I think of a pimple, I think of something red and inflamed. Mm. There's hormonal acne, which we see in mostly women on the lower face and jaw. And then there's more serious types of acne, like acne conglobata, which is more of a scarring acne. Any type of acne can scar, though. And then there's acne fulminans, which are our most serious type of acne. And so, I'm going to remove the last two, just focusing on the first few, inflammatory, comedonal, hormonal. And so then after I determine the type of acne they have, then I start thinking about how much does this affect people. So I always ask people from 0 to 10, how much does this affect you? How much do you not like it? Because if it's a 3, which is, let's say, a 14-year-old boy whose mother brings them in, the mother probably hates the acne. The kid may not care. And so if it's a 3, you don't want to give them a bunch of medicine that they're not going to use. Give them like one cream that they could put on once or twice a day and hope they use it. But if it's a 7 or a 6, that's pretty significant. And so you want to, you know, really treat those patients. The other thing I think about is if they scar, because some people just get an acne bump and maybe that heals and there's nothing there. Or maybe it heals and they have a blemish, which is a dark spot. Well, that will fade. But some people, they get an acne bump and then they get a scar. Mm. And so especially when you get a young person, you want to prevent that scarring, because acne bumps come and go, scars stay. And so I tend to treat people with scarring acne a little bit more severe or aggressively than someone who doesn't scar.
Are there certain people that are more prone to scarring than others, or is it some way that you're treating the acne that leads to scarring?
I have not been able to pinpoint that. Scarring, I think, is mostly genetic. If you look in someone's family history, like look at someone's father and mother, did they have scarring acne? That means this person probably could also have scarring acne. Some people think it's because people pick. Not necessarily. You know, I have people that pick and they don't get a single scar.
They're picking at their pimple or squeezing or their blemish.
Okay. Yep. And then I have people who get one acne bump and get a whole scar, and they never, you know, they don't hardly touch it. So scarring is mostly genetic. Acne is mostly genetic. And so, you know, so then after I determine the type of acne, how much it bothers them, and then assess the severity, then I kind of take them through what treatments we should offer them. And it's based on those factors.
Are all of the treatments that are offered, are they all prescription treatments, or what is the range of treatments?
Yeah, mostly. So, So there are some over-the-counter, especially washes that I recommend, but I kind of lump everything into topicals versus orals. And then, you know, I lump everything into conservative versus aggressive. So conservative are topicals, and there's a variety of topicals. There's Finacea, which is azelaic acid, 15%. There's clindamycin solution. There's topical dapsone. There's topical tretinoin, and the different strengths. Those are creams that you put on the skin. They don't go in the body. They're usually very safe. Most of them cause some degree of irritation, so I have people use moisturizer with them. But I think they're mild conservative.
And those are prescription topicals.
They are. And they're great for as a single agent, or maybe just two of those for mild acne. Once you start getting into like moderate to severe acne or scarring acne, you really do want to use an oral medication. Now, some people are against being on oral medications, but I'm always just really upfront with them. You could either chase the acne with a topical, or we can like get on top of it with an oral. And so for orals, you know, for men or boys, we could offer antibiotics or Accutane. And then for girls, we could offer those same medications with hormonal targets like spironolactone and oral contraceptive pills. And so it kind of depends on what the patient wants to do. I let the patient guide me as far as how aggressive they want to be. Usually I feel like patients, by the time they come in the dermatologist, they want to be a little more aggressive. But I usually map it all out for them, and I let the patient kind of guide me to where, you know, what we should do. And then if they fail a treatment, then I always escalate. You know, in a lot of patients, we have to escalate to oral antibiotics or Accutane even.
When you're treating with the topical medications, are they always treatment? You have acne and then you're treating it to get rid of it, or are they preventative as well?
That's a fantastic question. I tell patients that what you come in my office with, those bumps, I can't do anything about them. The cat's out of the bag. They're there. My job is to prevent future breakouts. So when you see an acne bump on someone's face, from the time that bump comes up, that bump has been forming for probably 3 or 4 weeks. They just didn't know it. And then it comes to a head and now they see it. So once it's there, there's nothing I can do. The medicine prevents future breakouts. So I tell people that because if you start treatment, you probably won't see any results till about 4 weeks in. And you don't know the end result till you're almost 3 months in. So I don't even see people back for 2.5 to 3 months. And then that's when I determine if a medicine is a success or a failure. There are some patients that will start medicine and then stop after 4 weeks because they see no results. And I say, no, keep going, because a lot can change between week 4 and week 8 as you're really getting caught up with that treatment. But acne in general takes 2.5 to 3 months. Anything shorter, you're just doing yourself a huge disservice. You really have to give it time. It's not like treating a rash. You put a cream on and it gets better after 2 applications. You really have to give it time. And so we are treating future breakouts.
So if you're preparing for something, a special event, you have to have time in order to start this regimen and be consistent with it. We have to take our first break, but I do want to get a little bit more into Accutane and more about acne when we come back. You are listening to Line One, Your Health Connection. If you have a question or comment for our guest today, give us a call statewide at 1-888-353-5752, 1-888-353-5752. Or in Anchorage at 907-550-8433. After this short break, we will continue our discussion of common skin concerns with dermatologist Dr. Courtney Bagayoko as Line 1 continues statewide. Welcome back to Line 1, Your Health Connection on Alaska Public Media. I'm your host, Dr. Jillian Woodruff. I'm joined by our expert, Dr. Courtney Bagayoko, owner of Anchorage Dermatology and Cosmetics. She is highly trained in complex medical dermatology, but also specializes in hair loss, vulvar skin disease, and cosmetics. We are discussing common skin conditions and treatments. Have you experienced acne and want to know treatment options? Give us a call toll-free statewide at 1-888-353-5752. In Anchorage at 907-550-8433. Or email us at line1@alaskapublic.org. Okay, so back to acne. You talked about the topical treatment options, and then you mentioned Accutane. and that's our oral Retin-A, I guess. And there's topical, and you mentioned the topical ones. But tell us about Accutane, because I know there's a lot of hesitancy and a lot of people who may not have even tried it, but know someone else that had a bad experience with Accutane. So what do we need to know about Accutane, and who's the best person to have this treatment?
Yeah, so Accutane, well, let's call it isotretinoin, because that's the actual name. It's an oral medication. It's an older medicine at this point. My mother told me she was on Accutane or isotretinoin back in the 70s or 80s. So it's been around for a long time. We know a lot about it. You know, it has absolutely revolutionized the way we practice medicine, the way we practice dermatology, the way we treat acne, seeing that it's like the most common condition we see. And it's not a cure, but by golly, it's close to a cure, because you can do a course of Accutane and, you know, go several years without having any breakouts or any pimples. And that's, you know, a major thing for people in their 20s who are trying to meet someone, who are trying to build a family or trying to establish their career, establish their life, you know. So I think it's major. But it's an oral medication. It's what we call a retinoid. It's derived from vitamin A. It's a pill you take every single day. There is a lot of red tape around it, which is probably the most frustrating thing about it. So when I assess a patient and I determine they need isotretinoin, either because they failed previous treatments or because their acne is really severe, we have to register them in a system called iPledge, which the best way I could describe it is you're pledging not to get pregnant. That's the main thing with acne.
This can cause birth defects.
It can cause serious birth defects. So you cannot get pregnant on it. A woman has to be on two forms of birth control in order to be on the medication. Men don't have to go through nearly as many tests and things like that. We do check blood work on isotretinoin, because it can make the liver a little inflamed. It can make your cholesterol go up. In young people, if they're athletes, if they're soccer players and track athletes, it can cause a little bit of muscle pain and joint aches that I screen for. If you have a history of a mood disorder, so schizophrenia, bipolar disorder, depression, anxiety, it can certainly exacerbate those. So I'm always screening for that as well. You can't take it with certain other acne medications, so I don't generally give it with doxycycline or minocycline, which are other acne oral medications, because they can cause some
problems. Antibiotics.
Mm-hmm. There's a negative drug interaction there. So once you know all that, because of all that, this medicine has gotten a pretty bad reputation. But, you know, on a day-to-day, I don't generally have many side effects. Don't get me wrong. Patients do have side effects. Most of them are manageable and decrease once we reduce the dosing or the frequency of the medication. And so most patients, I would say 95%, I can give Accutane perfectly safe. There are the few patients, though, that can have a negative side effect. I've never had anyone have like permanent side effects from it. But it is a really fantastic medication, because it really does clear acne, and it really is for the long term. So in general, doxycycline and minocycline and even spironolactone, it only treats the acne while you're on it. So once you come off of it, your acne will flare eventually. Whereas isotretinoin, once you come off of it, your acne can stay clear, especially if you've gotten a high enough dose over time. And so that's the really special thing about this medicine.
That is very special, and a nice distinguishing feature of that from the other treatment options. So if you do not have those side effects, then that could be a wonderful treatment option for you. Let me ask you about the topical version and how that's used.
Yep. So you're referring to tretinoin, which is also, again, another retinoid, a topical retinoid. There are different strengths. I just kind of say low, medium, and high. You know, when I was in North Carolina, I never gave the low strength. I only gave the medium or high strength. But here in Alaska, because it's so dry, I mostly give the low strength, sometimes the medium strength. But this is a cream. It also comes in a gel. It goes on a pea-sized amount to your entire face every night. The sun inactivates it, so you only want to put it on at night. And the best way I could describe the way it works is that it helps the skin cells start to divide and differentiate at the same rate. And so in order to do that, you have to, you're going to end up being scaly and a little inflamed the first 4 to 6 weeks. I always encourage patients to kind of push through that initial 4 to 6 weeks of being a little flaky and dry. That usually sorts itself out. But I think overall, you know, this cream helps to treat acne. And the other benefit is it kind of beautifies the skin overall because it helps with pores, it helps with fine lines, it helps with discoloration somewhat. It just helps people look a little bit more shiny, and it helps improve the overall quality of the skin. And so that's actually probably one of the main reasons I prescribe the medicine, is just to beautify the skin. But it also is FDA approved for acne. And I think it's one of the best topical medications you can give for acne.
And so that's given as a treatment, but also can be used for prevention.
For acne?
For acne.
You know, I don't, it has so many side effects with just being flaky and a little irritation and even inflammation for some people. I don't really give it for prevention. I usually give it to treat, I'll give it as a solo agent to treat mild acne. Mm-hmm. You know, if I'm going to try to prevent acne, I am usually focusing on more washes and moisturizers and things like that. I don't know how much tretinoin really prevents acne, because honestly, with acne, you're either going to get it or you're not. It's mostly genetic. It's 90% genetic.
So after you've treated someone mm-hmm. for acne and they are successful with their treatment, how do you help them to maintain their success and prevent future occurrences?
That's a great question. So, you know, so now you're saying someone has acne and we've been able to control the acne with either oral, topicals only, topicals and orals, or orals only. And so, you know, how do we go forward? So my idea is that you want the patient to be on the least amount of medicine possible to stay clear, especially an oral medication. So let's say they're on doxycycline or minocycline and they're taking 1 or 2 pills a day. Well, now it's like, well, can they go down to 2 pills a week, 3 pills a week to try to keep their acne away? Can you switch them to topicals only to keep their acne away? You know, and so it's usually staying on some of these same medications, but maybe reducing the frequency that they're applying it, so they're not so annoyed putting on medicine every day or taking a pill every day.
It's more of a maintenance.
It's more maintenance, exactly. And then you really have them focus on, you know, high quality washes, moisturizers to keep the quality of the skin intact. And then obviously if there's anything they're doing that's contributing to the acne, whether it's their hair care practices or, you know, something work related that's causing the acne, you're trying to adjust those things.
Okay. Well, before we switch gears, I want to take one of our callers that has a question about long-term tetracycline use. We have Chris. Hi, Chris. Welcome to Line 1.
Hello.
Hello.
Hello. The question is, when I was young, junior high and high school, my brother and 2 sisters and I lived where it's in Texas, where it was really hot. We all had acne, and my father was a physician, and he would get quantities of tetracycline, hydrochloride, from the detail men, and that was his way of treating us, is we would take anywhere from 200 to 600 milligrams twice a day. I know I did, and my sisters and brother took those pretty much through junior high and high school. My question is, do they still count?
I think you're breaking up a little bit. The connection isn't that good, but you're asking about...
It's not.
Okay, go ahead. What was the question?
It's not good because I'm in a remote cabin, but...
Oh,
anyway, I guess my question is, long-term side effects of taking tetracycline when you're a junior.
I think the long-term side effects in a young person of this antibiotic.
Yeah, you know, so I think the thing I worry about the most, and I'm not going to say I worry about it a lot, but I worry about somewhat, especially in young people, is just antibiotic resistance over time, especially if you're taking them and they're not being managed for years and years. So in general, what I try to do is put patients on, so doxycycline and minocycline are tetracycline family antibiotics. We don't really use tetracycline anymore. We use doxy or minocycline. And so if someone doesn't want to do Accutane, I say, okay, well, then let's do 3 months on doxy. And then once you're on after that 3 months, let's taper you and bring you off the medicine. And then you'll stay off the medicine until you flare again and you'll go back on it. And I tell people, you know, if you need more than like two courses of doxy over a year's time, you probably need to do isotretinoin, because you do worry about the antibiotic resistance from being on an antibiotic long term. I don't think doxycycline and minocycline are, let's say you get some resistance, and that could be problematic. Thank goodness there are a lot of other antibiotics you could use for, if someone gets an infection. So doxy has MRSA coverage. I think it treats staph strep, and it has good MRSA coverage, but there are also other antibiotics to treat MRSA. And so anytime you're treating
a serious skin infection that is not easily treated with the antibiotics we typically use to treat it.
Exactly. So anytime you're using these medicines, you have to weigh the risks and the benefits. And so if, you know, there's a risk of antibiotic resistance, but if the benefit is helping someone with severe inflammatory acne, then that's the risk you're willing to take. And so, the answer is, I do somewhat worry about long-term antibiotic resistance.
And the more we learn about, you know, antibiotics and our gut health, there's still a lot that needs to be uncovered when it comes to the long-term use of antibiotics. Mm-hmm. But just like you said, with anything, there's the risks and the benefits, and mm-hmm. it probably worked for him and his family to mm-hmm. be on those antibiotics. Before we move away, we do have an email from Susan, who wants to know, is it a myth that chocolate and other sweets contribute to acne?
I think that's a great question. No, I don't think it's a myth. So we know that certain dairy products, especially like skim milk products, and also high glycemic foods, so sugary sweet foods, contribute to acne. Now, as I said, acne is mostly genetic. It's either in your genes or not. And that really determines if you're going to get acne. I don't know the exact number, but I would say it's 90% genetic. And then there's the environmental stuff, what we eat, what we're exposed to, that contribute with
things that are inflammatory to us.
Exactly. So, if someone, let's say I have a patient who goes on a clean diet for their acne and they're just eating, you know, their vegetables, some meat, some lean meats, they probably will still have acne. Would it be slightly better? Maybe. But they'll still have acne because, as I said, acne is mostly genetic. And so there is a role in high glycemic foods, maybe worsening acne or making it less treatable. So, sugary chocolate is a high glycemic food. but even if you eliminate that, I find that people still have acne. Maybe it's a little better.
Yeah, I find that around holidays and when you're not watching your diet, I certainly do have breakouts in those times. When I'm good with the diet, it is good. But during the holidays and times when I'm not eating very well, I do have some skin issues. Mm-hmm. We're going to go on to our next question because we want to tackle dry and itchy skin too. So let's hear from Mike, who's from Homer, has a question about rashes from skin condition or from a medical condition.
Hi.
Hello.
Hi, my question is, my daughter, she was recently diagnosed by a rheumatologist. She has spondylitis arthritis. And now she takes Humira, but through her childhood and adulthood, she still experiences rashes and skin rashes. And when we went in to see the rheumatologist, he was making an observation whether she had eczema or psoriasis. How would somebody go about trying to find out the difference? It's during the winter months that seems to flare, but she has it on different parts of her body. Her arms, appendages, even on her buttocks.
This is a great transition to talking about dry and itchy skin, specifically about eczema and psoriasis. So we're going to move into that topic and let's learn about dry and itchy skin. And the interesting thing you said was about the arthritis and how interesting it is that medical conditions can exacerbate or displace skin conditions or rashes or eczema or psoriasis. So let's talk about eczema. What is eczema and what are the signs of eczema?
Okay. And I'm for that gentleman, I'm sorry to your daughter. I'm sorry that she's going through having an autoinflammatory condition mm-hmm. and also has, sounds like, some chronic skin issues. You know, eczema is, I would say it's kind of an inflammatory / allergic dermatitis that affects the skin. I shouldn't say allergic because it's not really a skin allergy, but we do see it in patients who tend to have allergies.
Allergies are like the trigger for their
not necessarily.
Eczema,
it's meaning they're associated. So patients who tend to have a lot of food allergies and environmental allergies also have eczema. Mm. But if you treat the allergies, it doesn't necessarily improve the eczema. But then there is this very small cohort of patients that could have severe eczema from an allergy, meaning if you treat that allergy, the eczema gets better. But that is not super common. And so I think there's a misconception that people have eczema because they're allergic to something that's giving them eczema. No, if you're allergic to something, giving you a rash is a contact dermatitis. Mm. Eczema is not generally from an allergy. It's inflammatory. Again, it's something in the genes. It's not to say environment doesn't affect eczema, but it's something we inherit. So if you ask an eczema patient, I'm sure one of their parents or grandparents probably has eczema. Teasing out eczema versus psoriasis is something that a healthcare provider, mostly a dermatologist, needs to do because they could look very similar, but they are different to the trained eye. And so, you know, eczema is itchy, dry skin. I call it I was trained at least to call it the itch that rashes. So you have an itch, you scratch it and it gets worse. It turns into more of a rash. So then it's more itchy, you scratch it and it gets worse. It generally is on the flexure aspects of the elbow. So the front of the elbow, the back of the knees. It could also be
like
on
the inside of your arm.
The inside. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. It could also be on the hands. It could commonly involve the eyelids and the nipples. So that's often a clue that I'm dealing with eczema. Eczema also is very ill-defined. So it's ill-defined, scaly, lichenified plaques that are itchy, meaning you can't take a marker and draw around eczema unless it's like nummular eczema. It's pretty ill-defined.
So there's no like specific border
exactly
that marks it from normal skin.
Exactly. Exactly. And it could be really tricky to diagnose in African-American, especially children, because sometimes African-American, or I should say children of color, have just little follicular papules or bumps just on the trunk that is a sign they have eczema. They could have the other stuff too.
Is that a raised lesion or is that like a flat color change?
It's a slightly raised little bump around the hair follicle.
Little bump. Okay.
And it could just be on the trunk. And I think that could be pretty tricky to diagnose. But eczema is very itchy. And psoriasis is somewhat itchy, but eczema is very itchy. And it could keep people up at night. People don't get great sleep. So it affects their quality of life. They wake up with blood on the sheets from scratching.
Is there a cure for eczema?
There is no cure.
So
most of the things we're talking
condition?
About, there's no cures.
Oh, my.
It's a chronic condition. It usually comes up in childhood. Most people, the people who tend to be more severe, present in childhood. But then, you know, I have people that go their whole life that don't have eczema. And then at 60 years old, they start having eczema and they can't believe it. You know, and I'm like, yes, it can come up at any age. But usually people have some breakout in childhood and then it can go quiet for decades. Psoriasis, on the other hand.
Actually, before you get into psoriasis, Dr. Bagayoko, let's take our last break.
Okay.
Yes. And then we'll talk more. So let's take another short break for the stations down the line. If you have a question or comment for Dr. Bagayoko today, give us a call statewide at 1-888-353-5752 or in Anchorage at 907-550-8433. We'll continue our discussion of common skin conditions when we return. You're listening to Line One, Your Health Connection on Alaska Public Media. Welcome back to Line One. I'm your host, Dr. Jillianne Woodruff. Our expert today is board-certified dermatologist Dr. Courtney Bagayoko. For several years, she cared for patients at Alaska Native Medical Center before founding Anchorage Dermatology and Cosmetics. She provides comprehensive care addressing an extensive spectrum of skin and hair conditions with precision and compassion. Do you want to join our conversation today and get your questions answered? Call us toll-free statewide at 1-888-353-5752, in Anchorage at 907-550-8433, or email us at line1@alaskapublic.org. Okay, so before the break, you were talking about eczema, and then you were just going to move into psoriasis and talk about some of the symptoms that come along with that.
Yeah, so again, as I was saying, sometimes it could be difficult to differentiate eczema from psoriasis. So moving on to psoriasis, although it can look like eczema, it tends to be different in that the plaques of psoriasis tend to be very well-defined, meaning you could take a marker and draw around a psoriasis plaque. They don't tend to be ill-defined. They're also much more inflammatory. The pathogenesis is highly inflammatory, so it's a pure auto-inflammatory condition. The plaques are much, we actually say salmon pink colored plaques is what we say in our textbooks, covered with a silvery scale. Now, obviously, if someone has psoriasis plaques in like their armpits or under their breasts or in their groin, they're not going to be scaly because it's more moist areas. So they're just kind of bright pink. Psoriasis also doesn't tend to be as itchy. It's itchy, but it's not as itchy as eczema. I think if someone has one of these conditions on their hands or feet, it's very difficult to parse out which one. Sometimes you got to do a biopsy. And then sometimes you could have patients with like nummular eczema. That's eczema that exists in well-defined circles on the body. You sometimes have to do a biopsy to differentiate that from psoriasis. The other thing is there is a condition called psoriasiform dermatitis.
Ooh.
Which is, it's a condition that exists on a spectrum between eczema and psoriasis. And sometimes it's hard to commit to one or the other. And sometimes you have to, patients are so miserable, you have to choose a treatment. And you choose the best you can, hoping it works. And then if it doesn't, you'll maybe use an eczema medicine. And if it doesn't work, you'll switch to a psoriasis medicine. And that's more of like the art of medicine versus the science. Sometimes we just don't have exact answers. And, it's why they call it the practice of medicine, because sometimes you have to figure it out. And so I have a few psoriasiform dermatitis patients. They're usually very difficult patients. But once you commit to either eczema or psoriasis and you're able to nail down a diagnosis, there are so many different treatments, especially for psoriasis compared to eczema. But there's a lot of different treatments we can do to get folks better. And most patients we can get better. We can make their psoriasis or eczema pretty quiet. There are some patients, though, that despite your best efforts, they just still flare. They still have some plaques and things like that.
Now, the caller mentioned the arthritis picture with his daughter. Is there more of a thought of it being psoriasis if you have joint pains or arthritis?
Yep. So it sounds like she has spondyloarthritis. I might be saying that wrong. I'm not a rheumatologist. And it's his daughter. I didn't get the age, but maybe she's young. These arthritides are auto-inflammatory. And I have found that when you have an auto-inflammatory condition, there's a higher risk you could have another auto-inflammatory condition.
Oh, yes, definitely.
And psoriasis is very inflammatory. So it's not uncommon that we see patients who have rheumatoid arthritis or something like that with psoriasis. It's not to say she doesn't have eczema. She could have eczema. But given she has an autoinflammatory condition so young, she could have psoriasis as well. I would encourage that gentleman to get this young girl into a dermatologist, especially a peds derm, to maybe be evaluated and treated. Because, if she's already being treated with Humira, that would help with her psoriasis. If it doesn't, then it may not be psoriasis, but you have to kind of parse that out with a good clinical exam.
We have an email that wants to know more about treatment options for eczema. This one, she does have diagnosed eczema, and this eczema has persisted for about 15 years. No treatment has been successful. Various steroid prescriptions and over-the-counter remedies have been tried. So are there any new developments in the treatment of eczema? She's heard about tacrolimus, but she's concerned about the side effects. And then my question is, for her, are we sure that this is eczema?
Yeah, so let's start with the treatments, because that's kind of an easier question to answer. You know, the treatments for eczema have changed over the last 10 years. You know, we've come a long way with eczema treatments. So previously, we would start with topical steroids. So, you know, mild would be like hydrocortisone desonide, moderate is, or medium strength is like triamcinolone, super potent or potent is halobetazole, clobetazole. And then, and those are steroids, topical steroids. They're very useful in eczema, especially like my go-to is triamcinolone on the body with a high quality moisturizer. So I say either the Cetaphil cream or a CeraVe cream in a jar that you can get at Costco. Once you get, and then there's also light-based therapy, which is getting in a light box and getting narrowband UVB.
Once so UVB rays.
Yes. Okay. Yeah. Once you get, you know, so once you do that, well, there are those treatments. And then there's a different set of treatments called steroid sparing creams and ointments. And those are called calcineurin inhibitors. And that is tacrolimus topical. And the other one is pimecrolimus. And so those are steroid sparing, meaning they're not steroids. They don't have the same side effects as topical steroids, and we could use them long term for maintenance. Now, if you read the package insert for those calcineurin inhibitors, it's scary, but the package insert refers to if those medicines are used orally for like transplant patients, not, you know, topically for
eczema
patients.
Absolutely. We have the same issues in our field with estrogen creams.
Exactly.
Yes.
So these, you know, going on, the skin is an amazing barrier. So if you put medicine on the skin, by and large, it's not going to be absorbed. By and large, I mean, very, very, very small amount, like a negligible amount gets absorbed. So they really just work at the level of the skin. And I think basically as long as steroids and non-steroidals are used responsibly, they are very safe. And I prefer to do those as much as possible because they don't go in the body. Once you get beyond the point where those help you, then now you're talking about steroids like prednisone, which you could take by a shot or, you know, orally. And then there were the immunosuppressants, which we used before, like methotrexate and Imuran or azathioprine and mycophenolate mofetil. We don't really use those anymore. Those medicines suppress the immune system and have a lot more side effects, although they are very useful for people with moderate to severe eczema. Well, now we have newer medicines that are, some are pills, some are injectable, for people with moderate to severe eczema that fail topical steroids and fail calcineurin inhibitors and fail light. And so Dupixent came out in around 2017, 2018, came onto the market. It's an injectable. It's given twice a month, so every other week. And I love Dupixent because it works phenomenally. It's a really good medicine. There are ads for it everywhere I'm seeing on social media, but it's also a very safe medicine. I feel like it's just as safe as it is efficacious. And that is awesome in our field for eczema, because we treat so much eczema. Now we have a medicine that works really well and is very safe. And even when we think about safety for it, you know, what do I worry about? Irritation of the eyes, injection site reactions, and upper respiratory infections. But I don't see it that often. And then there's the newer medicines, which we call JAK inhibitors. These are mm-hmm. the newer class of medicines. The one I use, I reserve it for patients who fail Dupixent, is Rinvoq. And that's a pill.
I've seen those commercials as well.
Mm-hmm, it's a pill. If you read the package insert for Rinvoq, it has a lot more side effects than compared to Dupixent, which is why I reserve it for people that fail Dupixent. But it also works very well and overall is very safe. Now, when you look at the side effects, those side effects are mostly for rheumatoid arthritis patients. Eczema patients tend to be a little healthier. We tend to not see some of the side effects, but you can see side effects definitely at a higher frequency than like a Dupixent. But it works very, very well.
So there are some newer therapies out there. So see the dermatologist and figure out what the best treatment is for you. I'm so happy, Dr. Bagayoko, that you will be with us for another hour to pre-record an episode about cosmetics and skincare. And we will address some of the questions that came in during this program at that time. I want to let you in the show because we didn't speak about sunscreen. So just about 30 seconds to tell us about sunscreen because we can't end without talking about that.
Okay, I have 30 seconds. Well, you know, I am a believer in wearing sunscreen. I think sunscreen has two important functions. Number one, to protect the skin and help reduce the incidence of skin cancer in an individual. It also has a huge anti-aging benefit as well, especially for folks that are Fitzpatrick 1 or 2 or 3, which are lighter complexion patients. But honestly, kind of for all patients, sunscreen does help slow down aging. And so I always recommend daily an SPF 30 or above. And if you're going to be in a higher UV climate like Hawaii, go up to like a 50 or 70.
Absolutely. I don't know any dermatologist that doesn't wear their sunscreen. Our thanks to our expert, Dr. Courtney Bagayoko, for being with us today. Thanks to our audio engineer, Chris Hyde, and our producer, Madeline Rose. You can find more information on this and previous programs on our website at alaskapublic.org. Let us know your thoughts or suggestions by emailing us at line1@alaskapublic.org. This has been Line One, Your Health Connection. I'm your host, Dr. Jillian Woodruff. Thank you.
Line One is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the host and participants and not necessarily those of Alaska Public Media, this station, or its underwriters. Learn more about Line One and listen online at alaskapublic.org. This is Alaska Public Media.